We wrapped up this morning in our study, review of the Book of Lamentations, only five chapters, and we introduced in our sermon this morning a brief overview of the opening chapters of Ezekiel at that time. And so we are going to introduce it. There are a lot of material presented in the online notes. I'm not going to read all of it, but I'm going to hit some of the highlights, incidentally, just so I keep this straight. This is our review for Sunday evening, August 30th, in our Everyday with God series. All the notes, as always, are kept online at thebible.net/EDWG. All of the files are up through today, with the exception of this one. The audio and the video will be up later this evening, but all the links are already active. So what do we say about Ezekiel that's significant that we want to mention as we get started right now? There are three ways, three different time periods that we can identify the prophets. They either come before, during, or after the exile. And the exile is usually understood to be the Babylonian exile. Isaiah and Jeremiah and Lamentations that we just mentioned are primarily before the exile. I say primarily because Jeremiah bridges the period before the exile and the period of exile. Haggai, Zechariah, Malachi, those gentlemen prophesying after the exile is complete. But Ezekiel and Daniel are primarily exilic prophets. That is, they are prophesying to God's people who are in the middle of Babylonian captivity. And so if you remember, our lesson started this morning by indicating that Ezekiel was with the other captives by the river Kabar, which was a canal system, an irrigation system off the Euphrates River. So he was in the heart of Babylon, not too far from the capital city. So that's the time period. The other thing is, prophets are usually identified as being northern or southern prophets. Those that would speak to the northern kingdom of Israel, that would be Amos, for example. And those that would speak to the southern kingdom of Judah, that would be, again, Isaiah and Jeremiah. There are a few exceptions. Jonah went and spoke to the city of Nineveh, the capital of Assyria. And then the exilic prophets, Ezekiel and Daniel, are talking to the people in captivity in the land of Babylon. So I'm not going to go through all of the material here. I want to notice specifically that the style of writing, I don't know if you can read that from where you are, but if you want to go to thebible.net/EDWG and scroll down, you'll see these notes that you can pull up on your phones, your tablets, your computers later, that the style of writing that is identified in Ezekiel, Daniel, parts of Zechariah, and also throughout the book of Revelation is called apocalyptic. And that's a 50-cent word that simply means something that is veiled is about to be unveiled. And so if you've ever gone to any kind of major art exhibition in which some new piece of art, sculpture, painting, whatever it might be, they're about to introduce it to the public, and it's usually draped in some fancy velvet cloth and whatever, and they're going to lift off the cloth and it's unveiled. That's the literal meaning of the term apocalyptic. It means it's going to be unveiled. The New Testament book called Revelation, that's what it, the term is, apokalypsis. That's the Greek term for revealing. That's why it's called Revelation. What was primarily before that revealed is now revealed, and so the veil is lifted. And so Daniel is a book that's like that, as well as Ezekiel. And so roughly in the middle of this paragraph, it talks about the nature of this kind of writings, what they're about. They use numbers, they use symbols, they use incredibly vivid images. We talked about that in part this morning, in order to convey an impression. Now let me emphasize an impression. The impression is not intended that everything within the illustration that's presented has some corollary, that it relates to some specific thing. The wheels within wheels don't have any specific meaning. The faces that are presented there of the man and the different beasts don't have any specific meaning. All of that is intended to demonstrate, to manifest the glory of God, which is exactly how the first chapter in verse 28 ends. This was a representation of the glory of God, and it was awesome. And when Ezekiel realized that, he fell down at the feet of God. That's the impression that the vision was designed to create. And so when you get a chance, let me encourage you to look at that. So let's look starting in chapter 1. The goal for the reading is to be through chapter 15 tonight. We may not get through all 15 chapters from the standpoint of reviewing it. And if that's the case, I will add later whatever we miss that we get to now and put it up in at least an audio file later. So the opening verses of the book of Ezekiel tell us about the writing. We again talked about that this morning, so we're not going to repeat too much. Ezekiel's 30 years old. Remember, he was a priest, but he's going to serve as a prophet. And at 30 years old, a man who was of priestly lineage could begin serving in the temple. But he wasn't where the temple was. He was in the land of Babylon. Furthermore, within 6 or 7 years after this, the temple's destroyed. So he couldn't serve as a priest either. So he was a priest in the genealogy of priests, but he's called to be a prophet. So that's a unique experience that we see presented here. And he's prophesying from within the nation of Babylon. So that sets the stage with what's going on. Jehoiakim, that's mentioned here, was the last king before Zedekiah, who was the puppet king that was established. And both of them, by this time, are in captivity. So everybody's led away. The army's led away. They're captive. They're going to be put into forced servitude when they get into the land of Babylon. All the elites are taken away. All the treasures of the king's house and the temple all taken away. And the people who couldn't fend for themselves are left behind. They weren't any good to the Babylonians. And so a third of the people were died, roughly. A third of the people left behind, and a third of the people carried away. And they're going to be in captivity for 70 years. So it's Ezekiel's job to preach to these people. Well, why? Jeremiah already said this is going to happen. They didn't believe it, and now it's happened. Why would you preach to people who already have been proven wrong? What Jeremiah said was happening, was going to happen, it's already happened. So you don't kick a dead horse. You don't beat a dead horse. It's dead already. Don't be preaching to us about us going into captivity. We're here. We got it. Well, the problem was they didn't think it was going to last very long. They thought as long as the temple was still standing, everything was okay. But within 20 years, the temple was destroyed, and the city was destroyed, and it wasn't okay. It wasn't okay even when they were thinking the wrong stuff. So they still needed to be convinced and convicted that they're here because of their shortcomings. God put you here because you made mistakes. You fell. You weren't living right in God's sight. So as you begin reading through this, the important thing is to understand that the people needed to learn lessons that they still hadn't allowed to sink in as fully as possible. So that's what we're going to see as you get into the rest of the chapter. So in chapter 2, we touched on this, mostly in chapter 1, and the notes that are here I'm not going to go back through because we did a fairly decent job of introducing that this morning. In chapter 2, after having seen this incredible vision, God says, all right, go tell the people what I want you to tell them. And we noted that this is parallel to what Isaiah was told to do in Isaiah chapter 6 and what John was told to do in the book of Revelation chapter 4, even before that in chapter 1. Go write these things down in a book and share these things to the churches of Asia, chapter 2 and chapter 3. So every time that there's a vision of God and somebody is brought into the presence of heaven metaphorically, they have a theophany, that is a manifestation of God's presence, they're often said, now that you've seen this, here's what I want you to do. Now, it's not the exact same thing that we see in Exodus 3. We did not mention that this morning, but it's similar. So Moses is out tending the sheep of his father-in-law, Reuel, also known as Jethro, and he sees a burning bush. And as he gets close to the bush, he says, well, it's on fire, but the fire doesn't consume the bush. It's a never-ending burning bush. The fire's not burning the bush up. So he goes to check it out, and God speaks to him from this context. So notice here's another appearance of God by means of the burning bush that's on fire. And after that, God says, I got a job for you. I want you to go and tell my people that I'm going to lead you out of the land of Egypt. You, Moses, the deliverer. Moses means drawn out. He's going to draw them out of the land as he was drawn out of the water. And Moses says, well, what am I going to tell these people when you tell me to do this? You tell them the God of the fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, has called you to this task. So every time that there's some manifestation of God's presence in the life of some great individual, there's a job. There's a job. There's a job. Samuel heard God speaking in the middle of the night, ran in to talk to Eli and said, what do you want? What do you want? I didn't call you. Second time, what do you want? You called me. I didn't call you. Third time, Eli realized, this is not me calling you. You're hearing a message from God. And in the context of that, he's got a job description. Without fail, that's what we see, that model. So he's told, you're going to go preach to this people. Well, what kind of people are they going to be? They don't want to hear what you've got to say. All right? How many people love salesmen? I didn't see anybody raise their hand. What you got against salesmen? Because they're always trying to sell you stuff. You walk in the store and you're on guard immediately. Can I help you? No. if you're mean and nasty, you might walk away. But salesmen are there to help you, not just to sell you something so they get a commission. Now, granted, some people are like that. I don't want to get into used car salesmen. You know, they have a reputation. I met one a few weeks ago that was a very decent, very honest man that was nice enough to buy the car that we've been trying to sell. That was Evelyn's brother's car for a long time. And he was honest and he was fair, and we were very appreciative of that. And so a salesman is trying to sell you something that you might not need. And you got a prophet here trying to tell you something you don't want to hear. And so there's a natural defense system that kicks in. We'll listen to you, but we're not going to do anything about it. We looked at text in the book of Ezekiel that literally said, we are not going to do what you've asked us to do. We're going to do what we want for our own gain. So, okay, Ezekiel, keep preaching. They've already told me they don't want to hear. Exactly what Isaiah was told he had to do. And so God tells him, don't be afraid of these people. These people will not want to listen to you, but you are preaching a message that is for their spiritual safety. So at the end of the second chapter, he gives him a book, and he's supposed to eat this book. This is a common model that we see in the text, saying that you are ingesting this book. It becomes part of you. It becomes part of your nature, part of your character, your mind, your heart, soul, and so forth. And now that it's a part of you, you've absorbed this, we want you to share this message with others. So again, in some context, you see that the book that they digest is often initially sweet. Oh, this is great. This is God's word. But then when you go to share God's word, it becomes bitter. Why? Because people don't want to hear it. So that's the job description that Ezekiel is tasked with. Beginning of chapter 3, the book that was presented in chapter 2, he digests this book. All right. So it means it's his duty to speak the word of the Lord. You consume my message, now you have to share it with others. That's part of what we do. All right. If you're going to school to be a teacher, you're learning all kinds of things that you are later going to share with others. Elementary, you know, high school, college, whatever it is, you are taught to teach. Well, Ezekiel, like most prophets, was called to teach. He was trained to teach. Let me teach you what you're going to say. Now go and say what I've asked you to say. So that's what he's supposed to do. So Ezekiel is further reminded, we saw this already in chapter 2, about the hardness of the hearts of the people that he's going to go preach to. Let me tell you, we're going to send you out to sell X's to people who don't think they need an X. But you need to do this because it's good for them. And so after a while of trying to sell an X to somebody who doesn't want an X, you think, this is a dumb job. I wish I was doing something else. I wish I wasn't doing this. In fact, I've been, you know, repudiated and rebuked and suffer so much. Again, remember Jeremiah suffered, you know, a lot of indignities and humiliation, threats on his life, thrown in prison and so forth, that you're not only ready to give up, you wish you were dead. Now, quite frankly, I've never wished I was dead. I hope I never wish I was dead. But being tasked with a job that God gives you and being so overwhelmed with the rejection that you are facing because of that task and wishing you were dead, that's a pretty serious thing. Now, we haven't seen that in Ezekiel yet. We saw it in Jeremiah. We saw it in Job. We saw it in others. Elijah, the same thing. You know, I'm the only one left. Why am I doing this? And so that's the job he's got. But the Lord realized he needed to be strong. You need to stand up to this people. You are doing what's right. All right. They may not think it's right, but it is right. So notice we're going to see in the third point, I don't know if you can see it, but God moved back and forth in time through the messages of Isaiah. Sometimes Isaiah spoke as if he was talking to the people right in front of him. Sometimes he spoke as if he's in the future speaking to those people right in front of him, but from the vantage point of the future. And sometimes he's speaking to people in the future that aren't there yet, and he's speaking as if they are there. Well, that's kind of confusing, but you need to keep in mind where he is in time and who he's talking to in that time frame so that the text makes sense. Well, Ezekiel does the same sort of thing, but he's taken in multiple places. And many of those places are visions like we saw in the first chapter. Let me show you a vision of what you're going to see in XYZ place at XYZ time. All right? That's what John sees in the visions that we see in the New Testament book of Revelation. He sees a series of seven seals. There's a reality to it, but it's figuratively presented. He sees a series of seven trumpets. There's a reality to it, but it's figuratively presented. And the same thing with reference to the last series of seven, the seven bowls or vials of God's wrath that's going to be poured out on the world at that time. And so he's taken to places that are visions that have connection to what's real. right? That's done lots of times throughout the biblical text. Jesus introduced smaller visionary things, so to speak, figurative illustrations by means of parables. He didn't literally have to point to a man going out to sow seed. People were familiar with that as an illustration. And he drew from that a very simple illustration about the significance of seed and the sower and so forth. Well, here the visions are a lot more fantastic, and that's why we mentioned the nature of the apocalyptic imagery and so forth. So all of that tells us that God is directing Ezekiel in what he says and how he says it and to whom he says it and what style of image that he presents. Now, we've hinted at this already, and we're not there yet, that God uses Ezekiel to act out a number of things. Later, he's going to use Hosea to act out things. He used Isaiah to act out some things in which something was done in his life that served as a real-life illustration of what God wanted them to know. And so that's going to be brought out repeatedly as we get further in the book of Ezekiel. Notice, in addition to being a prophet, we introduced this very, very briefly this morning, he was a watchman. He was a watchman. No modern means of technology, you know, couldn't text anybody when you see an enemy approaching. If a child's about to be kidnapped, you don't get an amber alert shows up on your phone like many of us might, or somebody calls you to tell you about that. So everything is going to be done by word of mouth. All right, they're messengers. You know, the predating of the Pony Express, they had a mail distribution system that's going to come into play during the times of the Medes and the Persians and so forth. But when you see impending danger and you're a watchman on the walls of the city, you've got to holler and let everybody know. This is much, much earlier than Paul Revere. The British are coming, the British are coming. Well, now it's not the British, but something that God wants you to know is coming. And so his job as a watchman was to look out for stuff that might be happening. Just imagine, you know, people in old movies and that kind of stuff, they were on the bows of ships or up in the crow's nest, and they were looking out upon the horizon saying, I see an enemy ship, and it's carrying XYZ flag. And so their job was to alert people as to what they see if there's an impending danger. And so that's part of his job description. So he's a priest, he's a prophet, he's a watchman, he's an actor, and I don't mean anything bad by that, in which he's acting out real life illustrations in his life to convince people to listen to him. So, and we're going to see this repeatedly. Point number 6 here, if you can't see it, I'll mention it again, it's in the notes. There is an individual responsibility that applies to everybody who was in captivity. There is a tendency in the nation of Judah to assume that everybody was saved or lost, protected or not, as a group, on a corporate basis. But one of the things that you see in a particular series of prophets is God says, I'm going to judge you individually based upon whether or not you have been faithful. Not about your mom, not about your dad, and not about your kids or anybody else. That's going to be a big message in the book of Ezekiel in the 18th chapter. And it's already been a message in Jeremiah chapter 31. This new covenant is going to be an individual covenant with every individual who has God's law written on their hearts. Not a law written on tablets of stone for the nation to see and to hear. And so there's going to be a growing sense of individual responsibility that's going to be brought out to the nation of Judah and to other people around the world. Well, Ezekiel is going to do some of that. So toward the end of the chapter, Ezekiel is again told about the reproach that he's going to receive because he's doing something that people don't want to hear. They're stubborn. They're hard-hearted. The scripture that Stephen uses in the context of his defense, in Acts chapter 6, Acts chapter 7, we see that whole setting set up, is that they were uncircumcised in heart and mind and ears. What's the point? They didn't want to listen. They were hard-hearted. All right, so chapter 4, we see a beginning of a series of signs that Ezekiel is going to use in order to convey the message that God wants the people to hear from the mouth of Ezekiel. All right. So, and they're talking about the destruction of the city of Jerusalem. Just remind ourselves this. The captivity starts in 606. The first people are going to be carried away. They're going to be carried away in three successive periods of exile, starting at that point, roughly 10 years later and roughly 10 years after that. So by the time the third carrying away, which is 20 years in, the city is going to be destroyed and the temple is going to be destroyed. But some people are in exile for up to 20 years before the city's destroyed. So that's why people were always saying, but the temple's still there, we're okay. So, but what if the temple's about to be destroyed? Never going to happen. Again, remember Jeremiah dealt with this, chapter 7. The people, you can almost see them pointing over their shoulder, the temple, the temple, the temple. Three times they said, it's here, it's here, it's here. Nothing can happen to us. Well, Ezekiel is going to tell them it's not going to be here for long. And so in this context, he's going to use several illustrations to emphasize the temple will be destroyed. Why would you not believe that? You didn't believe Jeremiah, who said you're going into captivity, and guess where you are? In captivity. I too am a prophet of God, and one of the ways that I can back up my prophecy is by means of these incredible visions and telling you what God has told me to reveal to you that's in concert with what the prophets have said before. This isn't anything new. Believe me, the city is going to be destroyed. That was just too much to take. Too much to take. Somebody comes and tells you tomorrow you have terminal illness and you're going to die in 3 months, how readily are you willing to accept that? I've been here for X number of years. Okay? Does how long you've been here guarantee that you will be here 1 minute longer? No. Israel has been a nation for 1,000 years. Please do not misunderstand what I'm about to say. That's four times, more than four times, the length that this country has been the nation that it is. 244 years we just celebrated. 250 times four is 1,000. Four times longer than this nation's been around, and God says, I'm going to take the temple down. They were very unlikely to believe that. And that's the message that Ezekiel's supposed to present to them. How well do you think it's going to go over? Well, about as realistic as it's going to go over when some popular politician or not so popular politician says, we're going to be taken captive by pick a nation in XYZ years. People are going to think, you are crazy. That's what they thought about Jeremiah. That's what they think about Ezekiel. You're crazy. You're already in captivity. That's the start. The temple will be taken down and the city will be destroyed. That's the finish. And later, God will let you go back. So you can see that there's an inherent resistance to the people listening to what Jeremiah is going to say. So Jeremiah gives a sign and he talks about the siege that's going to come. We already referred to that. Jeremiah talked about it. And he's going to talk about it. There's a siege that's coming. Just a reminder. Jesus does the same thing in the closing chapters of the book of Matthew with reference to the fall of the city of Jerusalem in his day. This is in 587, 70 years on the other side. So you got 650 years later, the city of Jerusalem is going to be taken again. And the temple that's going to be rebuilt when they come out of captivity, it's going to be destroyed, never again to be rebuilt. And people didn't believe Jesus either. That's one of the reasons they killed Stephen that we alluded to before. You've lied about the temple, you've lied about Moses, you've lied about the law. You deserve to die. And they killed him, just like they killed Jesus. Why? In part because of Jesus' claims, but in part because they didn't like what he said about the temple. It's going to go away. Listen, we've already had that happen once, Jesus. We've already had Jeremiah talk about this. We've already had Ezekiel talk about this. We finally admit that the temple was destroyed, but it's rebuilt. God's hand is with us again. That's not going to happen again. This time it wasn't 1,000 years into their history. It was only 650 years into history. And it's going to happen again, never to be rebuilt. So you don't have to worry about being destroyed again. It's not going to be destroyed again because it's not going to be rebuilt. That's the task that Ezekiel has. So he's going to give a number of illustrations saying this is definitely going to happen. Chapter 5. And again, I know I'm going quick. I understand that. But I want us to get some semblance of the gist of what we're presenting. And I'm not going to take the time to read this. We're assuming that you're doing this on your own. And again, all these notes that I'm just hitting the highlight of are brought out online. And later, if we have opportunity, if I need to do extra stuff, I will be a little bit slower and look at the text itself. So the series of signs continues. What's the purpose of the signs? To convince and to convict and to get people to change. Convince, convict, get people to change. And so one illustration hasn't done it. Second illustration hasn't done it. They've got to be repeatedly convinced and convicted of the message that he's delivering. So he gives them an illustration of hair. I alluded to that before this morning. All right? I wasn't offending anybody who's hair follically challenged. That's not my point. But here's the illustration that he gives. All right? Notice that. One third of the hair on his head was going to be burnt. One third of it was smitten, and the final third was scattered. Well, I don't want that to happen to my hair, quite frankly. But that's what is said to happen to Ezekiel. All right? So what's that about? It symbolized what was going to happen to the children of Israel. Some of them were slain, some of them were taken into captivity, and some of them died during the period of the siege. They don't just lay siege to a city and then say, you know, all the income free, everybody come out. When you resist for 2 years and they finally breach the walls and they come out and people try to escape, somebody gets killed. And that's what he's saying. The siege is going to come. The armies of Babylon are going to come against the city of Jerusalem. And finally, after they've waited you out and you've resorted to eating anything and everything, and resorting to cannibalism of children in your family, when you finally try to escape, your soldiers will be killed. And people will die. Because it told you, you're not supposed to do this. That's Jeremiah's message. So, here's the image that he presents. This is what's going to happen. So, why is this going to happen? Because they didn't do what God wanted them to do. Remember, going all the way back to the passage in 2 Kings and even in 1 Kings 8 at the dedication of the temple, and even going way back before that in the book of Deuteronomy, God says, when you are unfaithful to me in this land, I will remove you from this land and take you into a nation where you will be oppressed. Moses talked about it. When did he live? 1,500 years prior to the time of Christ. Solomon talked about it, the dedication of the temple. When's that? Roughly 550 to 600 years later. And the prophets have been talking about it ever since then. This is not new news. This is real news. And it's been talked about all this time. So you haven't been faithful to God. You followed the commandments of other nations and other gods. You should have understood this was coming. So again, lots of graphic illustrations that he's going to present in the text. Last part of the chapter, reference is given to the punishment that's going to come upon them. Why? You have become outcast to me because of your unfaithfulness. Just a reminder in the lesson we did that was to have done last Sunday morning that was done later, that's online. I reminded you and mentioned this in class that Lamentations chapter 2, I think it's verse 5 or 6, God says, I am your enemy. I'm the one who's done this to you. Why would God say I'm your enemy to his people? Because they had become his enemies. God was giving up on them because they had already given up on him. Not saying that they couldn't change that. All right, opening section of the chapter, more prophecies against the nation of Judah and the city of Jerusalem. Why? Because people are still in captivity. The city's still standing, but it's about to go away. Jeremiah said it. Isaiah said it. Ezekiel's saying it, only now it's even closer. The time is getting even closer. And so the prophets are becoming that much more urgent in their message. Again, remember, Isaiah was constantly in the face of people telling them about this. But now, the captivity's already started. They're 20 years in, and they still act as if this is okay because the temple still stands. Well, that's unique. All right? So he's going to predict what's going to happen to the mountains in Judah. Just a reminder that there are multiple hills in and around the city of Jerusalem. And one of them, called Mount Zion, which was the place of the threshing floor of Araunah, 2 Samuel chapter 24, where David halted the sacrifice because of the plague that came upon Israel, that became Mount Zion, became a very special place. And so to say that the mountains are going to be destroyed is in effect the same as saying everything on the mountains is going to be destroyed. And if the temple's on the mountains and the mountains are going to be destroyed, guess what? You can't destroy the mountain without destroying the temple. And so that's just one way that God tried to get their attention. Many times God would say, we mentioned this already, that God said, I'm the God of all nations. Well, if God's the God of all nations, then he's the God of the Jews. And so he says, if I'm going to do this to all the nations, do you think you're going to be able to escape this? So the destruction of the mountains indicated the destruction of the temple. All right, what's the point? Jerusalem's built on a series of hills. Even the temple was on one of them, but it's going to be brought down. So the last few chapters prior to Jesus' passion, in Matthew 24, 25, and 26, all the events that are brought out in all three of those chapters all happen in one day. And what's interesting is they're leaving the city of Jerusalem. Jesus is going back and forth from Bethphage and Bethany, which is about 3 miles, 5 kilometers or so outside of the city. And they're going up the ascent of the Mount of Olives. And as they're going up, one of the apostles says, see what manner of buildings these are. And he's talking about the glory of the temple. If you read in ancient historians, Roman historians, they talk about the grandeur of the temple as if when you first see it coming upon it in the bright sun because of its gilded nature and all the white marble, it just glistened and was just absolutely incredible to see. They said, look at these buildings. Look how incredible they are. This is not Solomon's temple. This is the rebuilt temple. This is the temple that started during the days of Zerubbabel, Ezra, and Nehemiah that had been expanded for 40 plus years during the time of Herod. And they couldn't understand what Jesus was about to say. You see these stones? every last one of them will come down. No stone will be standing. The wall outside still remains, but it wasn't the temple proper. The wailing wall that you've often seen in the news all the time, that stands. But the temple proper, not there. Gone. They couldn't believe that it was going to be destroyed. They were on a mountain looking up and looking back over where the mount, where the temple was, and just absolutely mesmerized about its beauty. Only to hear Jesus say, it's coming down. They didn't like that either. And so Ezekiel is tasked with an incredible task, telling people this is going to happen. When the mountains come down to the city, the temple will also fall down. So he talks about the remnant that's going to escape the punishment, some of which are in captivity now, and some of which are going to be scattered among the winds, the nations, and so forth. So again, Ezekiel's got an undesirable task, you know. He's selling something to people who don't want to buy what he's selling. Right, chapter 7. The whole chapter is devoted to the judgment that's going to come upon the nation of Israel. That's nothing new. That's consistent with what we saw before. Note the emphasis that's given repeatedly to the thought that we're receiving their just reward. What's that mean? You deserve this. You've earned this. What you have paid for is judgment. You haven't paid for blessings. All right. So God says, I'm going to recompense. I'm going to pay you back for the way you have lived, specifically referring to the sins that they've been living in. So in the chapter, we saw this before. Remember, the book of Lamentations opens with a woman that's described as a widow. And then immediately after that, she was described as a beautiful princess. And then she's described as a harlot. Wait a minute. That went downhill very fast. In this context, he's going to do the same thing. The beauties that you have, used to have, are gone. Physically, spiritually, gone. You are a shadow of what you were physically and a shadow of what you were spiritually. That's why these things are coming to you. So he constantly refers to the beautiful ornaments that had bedecked Israel as a nation, and they're all gone. He says they've all been given over to worship of false gods and other abominations. And so it also talks about punishment that's coming. They're already being punished in captivity, but it's going to be finalized by the destruction of the city of Jerusalem itself. Chapter 8, more visions. Again, what starts in chapter 1 is not the last of the visions. The visions continue, and they're all intended to have dramatic effect on those people who would hear and visualize them as Ezekiel is presenting them. So the book is divided between the visions which Ezekiel is directed to see, and then the prophecies that he's commissioned to share. And usually the prophecies follow on the heels of a particular vision that's going to lead into the message that he's going to proclaim. So the first vision declares, I am your God. And he falls down and he's just awestruck when he realizes he's before a holy God. And then he's given a commission. So after every vision, there's a message consistent with the vision that's just presented that he's supposed to deliver to the children of Israel. And so it's going to alternate between incredible visions and then what's built into that vision from the standpoint of the message he's supposed to deliver. All right? So he sees visions, and these visions focuses on not the greatness of God's holiness, like we saw in the first one, but the wickedness of the nation. And then he's got to go tell people about that. So Ezekiel's taken at one place to the north gate, the north door of the city of Jerusalem, and it's described in an image very jealously because that was, you know, the primary entrance and so forth, and you couldn't just go in and out that. You had to be special people to do so because they were God's special people, and God's indicating that you can't just walk into my presence. You have to come before me in the right way. Remember, Moses, when he saw the burning bush, one of the first things he hears from the voice within is, take off your sandals, take off your shoes, so to speak, because the place you're standing is holy. Why is it holy? Because I'm here. And so Jerusalem's represented as what it was supposed to have been from God's perspective, a holy city, because the temple was there. And God says, I'm jealous about who can go in and out of the gates of the city, and you have lost the privilege to do that. All right. So no other gods were supposed to come into the city, and you let them in. Again, I remind you of what we noted this morning. During the time that Manasseh was king, he not only allowed images within the city, but placed them in the temple proper itself, and had rooms dedicated to women who made clothing for the image that was brought into the temple. That wasn't at all authorized. So he says, this is what you've been doing. So as he continues the image, he keeps talking about the horrible things that were done in and around the temple, in which they were using what was designed to be a place for worship of the holy God, for anything and everything under that. So he sees images, he sees idols, he sees all kinds of creeping creatures and so forth. And he says all of these things have caused the pollution of the temple. And so this was not good. This is why these things are happening to you. Now, the reason why he's saying all these things and speaking so bad at the temple is hopefully people pick up on that. They're going to say, oh, we can see now why God did this to the temple. It became sin, like we became sin, like the land became sin. The land doesn't literally become sin, but it's so soaked in sin because of the people, God says, I'm going to take you out of it. This is a holy land. All the other lands are unholy. Well, you've made it like all the other lands because you profaned my worship. And so the same thing with reference to the temple. The temple that was intended to be holy has become so unholy, God's going to kick you out of it. By the way, he's going to destroy it. And you, as God's people, become so unholy, I can't stand you in my presence. You're out of the land. You're out of the temple. You're gone until you repent, and I'll bring you back. So all of this is to maintain the significance of God's holiness. Now it's interesting as a lot of these messages that were revealed to Ezekiel were done in darkness, which is kind of interesting, but all the sins that they represent were done in broad daylight. You can't miss this. Even in the darkness, you can see the sins that you were guilty of. You will be punished because you did these things in the light. Chapter 9, a brief slaughter of those people who are guilty is envisioned, saying this is what you're going to deserve. So Ezekiel sees six men coming from the north. Remember, he is a watchman, and so his job is to watch out for impending danger. And so that they're coming from the north, very frequently in the Old Testament prophets, destruction is said to come from the north, roughly where Assyria was and some other nations that would come against them. And so to say that judgment is coming from the north is saying some northern kingdom is going to come against you. And so it's going to come and it's going to bring punishment against you and against the city. So prior to that actual punishment, one of the men carries an ink horn. We don't use ink horns today. We don't dip our pens in ink. Maybe somebody does. Colt, do you do that as an artist? Using ink pens?
I have.
You have? So I like mechanical pencils. It's not exactly the same. It's kind of got lead built into it. But you've seen images of that and so forth. You have an ink horn with you?
Mechanical pencils.
But so the notion of using an ink horn was that there's a well of ink that you dip your pen in and so forth. And I'm tempted to say something about putting the mask over your mouth and keeping it closed, but I'm not going to say that, so pretend I didn't say that. I'm just joking. We're all in good fun. But my point is, he's going to say somebody's about to write something. And the significance of it is presented in this vision as if you need to pay attention with what's about to be said. And Daniel is going to reveal handwriting on the wall. And that something is written and called attention to means it's significant. God's about to write this down. Pay attention. God's about to speak. Pay attention. The way the book of Lamentations starts with saying, you know, alas, you know, this is a horrible thing that you're dealing with. Be careful. It's all intended to draw attention to something. So he comes with an inkhorn who went through the midst of the people to mark those people. Now that concept of marking is key. We see it in the book of Revelation, see it in the book of Ephesians. Many times we see the text says God knows those who are his. And there's usually an indelible yet invisible marking by which God can tell those who are his. And sometimes there's a physical marking by means of causing people to move. How many people are on the Lord's side and they move? Right? Who's on the Lord's side? Who's going to be part of Gideon's army? And they all come forward. It's just got too many, some of them we need to cut back. So there's a means of identification of who's right and who's wrong. And so this inkhorn indicating that they're dipping it in it and they're going to write up and make a mark on these people is an identifying characteristic. Not just to write something, but to identify. So how did they mark them? Not told. That's not significant. But it was for the purpose to distinguish those from the righteous, between the righteous and the unrighteous. reminder, when Jehu was called to be the means by which the Baal worship in the northern kingdom was eradicated, when they gathered all the Baal worshippers together, the first thing he did before he started getting rid of all the Baal worshippers, he said, "Is there any true worshiper of Jehovah God here? If there is, get out." Why? He wasn't called to destroy people who were worshiping God. He was called to punish those people and execute those people who were worshiping anything other than God. So the point is, they're distinguished. The book of Revelation talks about those who receive the mark of the beast. Figurative mark of the beast, or the mark of the second beast. But then it also speaks about those who are demarcated by God. God knew those who were his. They were even numbered, figuratively speaking, in the context. And so the point is, there was an identification mark to tell who was on the right side and who was on the wrong side. So after this is carried out, God knows who's going to be judged. Passover was a sense of marking. How did God know which houses not to punish? And a mark. What was the mark? The blood of a lamb slain without blemish of the first year. And the blood was on the doorpost and across the lintel. And God says, when I see this, I will pass over you. There was a divine marking to distinguish between those who were right and those who were wrong, similar to what we see here. So when the marking was carried out, those who were identified for destruction are ultimately going to be destroyed. You might say, well, that's sad. But it's not like there was no notice of this. It's not like there was no advance warning of this. It's not like they hadn't heard this message repeatedly many, many times. All right, chapter 10, we see another vision, and it returns to the vision that we saw initially at the very beginning of the book. So it's not introduced and developed and then fades away. It's going to be reintroduced later. So that same vision shows up again, alluded to briefly in prior chapters as well, is taken up. And so now we see a man clothed with linen, who in the last chapter was the one that was carrying the inkhorn that marked the people to determine whether or not they were going to be right or wrong. And he was instructed to gather coals and to scatter the coals around the city. Well, what do coals do? This is not coals that were dead and had not yet been ignited, but that were on fire. So the specific image is going to have reference again to the destruction of the city of Jerusalem, which after the siege was burned by the Babylonians. And so the image says, not only are some people going to be destroyed, but it's going to be burned by fire. And so, again, picturing the destruction of the city of Jerusalem. Hadn't happened yet. As long as the city stood, people thought, they're okay. But it is going to be destroyed. Then we see a description given of the wheels and the creatures in the wheels that are mentioned in the first chapter. The greatest significance is this, that it represents the glory of God. Verse 28 of the chapter tells us that. And that the departure of the glory of God, we didn't mention this in the lesson, but if you noted in the context that the vision that was pictured there was able to leave the ground and take flight. Well, it's not talking about the prediction of the invention of the airplanes or helicopters or hot air balloons or anything else like that. But it was going to indicate something about movement. And notice it says movement always went straight ahead. There was never anything turned. The point is, this is certain. This is going to be a straight ahead thing that's going to be developed. Well, interesting in this context, it departs from where it was. And it represents the glory of the God, a glory of God leaving where it was, leaving the temple proper. So the departure of the temple of the Lord from the temple set the stage for the temple's destruction. God's not here anymore. God's not here anymore. And a similar thing happens during the time of Jesus talking about the destruction of that temple. At the time that the temple was built, Solomon, his dedication says, God cannot be constrained by this temple. Indeed, God cannot be constrained by the entire physical creation. So if that's the case, is God lessened when a place that he asked to be built in his honor and glory is destroyed? No. God that couldn't be contained before is a God that still can't be contained after that. All right, Ezekiel chapter 11. We may get very close to where we want to be in the next few minutes. Ezekiel's again guided by the Spirit to see another vision. Again, there are lots of these apocalyptic visions. This chapter, he's led to see the sins of the princes of Israel. And the word prince there means any person in a position of leadership. Didn't have to be a literal prince, a son of a king, but it could have been anybody else who's in position of administration, leadership, including those people who would have been in the official court. And he's ultimately commissioned to rebuke them. Why? Because in large measure, the leaders weren't leading the people to do what was right. And so they're not all as bad as Jeroboam or Jehu or Ahab, as we saw in the northern kingdom, but they were, many of them committed their own sins even in the southern kingdom. So when the Spirit of the Lord comes upon Ezekiel, he informs him that the prince knew the things that had come to their minds, every one of them, and they're responsible for the death of others. Jeroboam, what he introduced, was responsible for introducing a sin that condemned so many people after him, and didn't think about the consequences of that. The consequences of our actions have impact on others, and sometimes, depending on your position, on a lot of people. A lot of people. So, chapter 11, continuing, number 3, next section of the chapter talks about the promise of restoration. Now, we mentioned this before in Lamentations. Almost the entire book, all 5 chapters, is supremely negative until you get to the last 4 verses, and there are 2 subtle hints of future glory to come. You might say, well, that's kind of negative overall. Yep, kind of like Job till you get to the end of the book. Kind of like Ecclesiastes till you get to the end of the book. You see the same thing going on in Lamentations. So here, even though there's a lot of judgment talk, there's still a hope of restoration to come in the future. It will come, but other things have to happen initially. All right, so notice this is the beginning of the end of the temple. In the concluding verses, God's glory moves. So this is an image. God's glory is moving. Well, where's it going? It's leaving where it was. All right. It was in the temple. Then it moves out of the temple to the gates of the city. Now moves to the mountain to the east of the city, later going to be known as Olivet, where Jesus wept for Jerusalem. And finally, it leaves completely. And so the presence of the Lord no longer there. And there's this slow, gradual departure that's chronicled here. Now the temple sanctuary is about to be destroyed. And so that's what he says is going to happen. Chapter 12, Ezekiel's instructed to act out. Noted this before. The different things that happened to his hair was one acting out. There's more that's going to be acted out. People, some of them still believe that even though they're carried away, even though got all this Jerusalem destruction talk and temple destruction talk, it hadn't happened yet, and so we still don't believe you. So he's got to give more signs. So in this sign, he acts as if he's gathering together belongings that would be taken if one were forced to flee suddenly. Jesus anticipates that with reference to the destruction of Jerusalem. He's told to act these things out in the sight of the people so they would see what he's doing. What are you doing? You're acting like you're going somewhere in a hurry. Yeah, that's right. But they were going to ask about them. When they asked, he's going to say, this is what's going on. Danger, destruction, punishment is about to come. You've got to be prepared to leave in a moment's notice. Passover. That's exactly what happened. Be prepared to leave. Because when Pharaoh says leave, we better go, because he's going to change his mind again. Comes after them as they're crossing the sea. They see the armies of Pharaoh behind them and so forth, even before they're crossing the sea. So be prepared. And so he's acting these things out. So all of those things typify, foreshadow the actions of Zedekiah. He's the king, the puppet king, who was going to rebel and made things worse. He was still in Jerusalem. Jeconiah was already in captivity. Zedekiah is still there. He's the last guy who's on the scene when the city is going to fall. And so some are going to be killed because he resisted. And the latter part of that chapter tells us about that. I've got 3 quick chapter reviews and then we'll finish so we don't have to do a separate lesson here. So he was talking about the false leaders. That's the princes. Now he's going to talk about the prophets. Here's a prophet denouncing other prophets. You might think, well, that seems kind of awkward. There's supposed to be honor among thieves. There's supposed to be, you know, people who are bad honor each other who are bad. Why is a prophet speaking against prophets? Because there's a distinction. True prophets, false prophets. Isaiah did it, Jeremiah does it. So he says, the things that people prophesy, peace, peace, when there is no peace, healing the hearts of my people slightly, the hurts of my people slightly, is what Jeremiah said. So a lot of people are talking about good things to come, and the true prophets are saying, not going to happen. And that's why Jeremiah was persecuted, and that's why Ezekiel's going to be persecuted. So he speaks against them because they lie. Where did that message come from? It didn't come from God. And so that too is going to bring about their punishment. Don't lie to people. Don't tell people something that God said when God didn't say it. There are proofs to determine whether or not a prophet was right or wrong. Deuteronomy chapter 13 is one passage that says that. Chapter 14 talks about the people and their idolatry. Only look at the place where their idols were, set up within their hearts and minds, in their imaginations. Not just literal physical idols, but they had those idols in heart and mind, which led them to have physical idols. So God's removed himself from them because they changed his will. and in part in their lives, but it started first because they changed their heart. So God says, I'm going to cut you off. You can't be my people. You're not being what I want you to be. And then latter part of the chapter again talks about the certainty of the destruction of Jerusalem. It's going to happen. It hasn't happened yet, but it's just about to happen. Chapter 15, last illustration, last chapter, will be up to where we need to be in our reading. Brief chapter of Jerusalem is compared to a vine. Compared to all the trees of the forest, a vine was of little value. Now, it's interesting that illustration is used repeatedly by the Lord saying, I took you as a vine from the land of Egypt, and I transplanted you to this place to produce good fruit. And so that illustration has been used repeatedly in prophets. It couldn't be used in industry for building and so forth, like trees and so forth. So its value was negligible, except that the Lord planted it. If, however, the vine were to be burnt, then its worth would be even less. And so his point is, Jerusalem is now a vine that's worthless compared to other things, and now it's about to be burnt, and it's even worth less. And so you were only worth something when you were doing what God wanted you to do. Now you are worth less than that. You've become useless like a burnt vine. That's not a very pretty picture. And all this was intended to convey the situation that led up to their destruction, which is just about to happen. We've got a few minutes, about 5 minutes past the hour. We're going to wrap up here. We will take up next Sunday morning in our review with Ezekiel 16. I'm going to double check real fast in our Bible reading schedule. Next Sunday morning is, going to be the 6th. So we will have read like 16 chapters from now. 15 is where we're ending. And so the next 7 days will be up to chapter 31. So we're only reviewing 16 chapters next week. That's not as a lot, except it's going to be very highly figurative. When you get to chapter 18, let me encourage you to read it two or three times, simply because of the significance of what it says about the transmission of sin from one generation to the next. That's a very powerful chapter. All right, let's be dismissed with a word of prayer. I encourage you to continue in your reading. And again, all of these files are already up with the exception of this audio and this video, which will be up later this evening. And I'll send notices out on the church's Facebook page. All right, let's have a word of prayer. And if there's any announcements that we need to make after that, we can do so. Yes?
Prayer request for Japan.
All right, can we do that after the prayer?
Yes.
That way I'll turn this off and we won't have the whole world seeing it. I'm not being critical of that. I'm just, let's do that first, if that's okay. All right? Thank you, though. Our Heavenly Father, we're thankful for the opportunity we have to be here and to review and study your word. We hope and pray that what we have done has whetted our appetites to learn more, and to not only learn more, but to be changed more by the word that we have we've read and that we've been convicted by, and to live in a way that's in harmony with that word and to share that with others. We're thankful for your son, thankful for your blessings, thankful for everything that you've allowed us to be and to do in your service. And we ask all of this in the name of your son, the Christ. Amen. Give me a second here. And I'll stop that. Go ahead, sir.
So Jamia gave me a call earlier today. She's not sure she can come back to the school because of possible exposure to COVID. So what happened is her brother...
Here or at home?
At home.
Oh.
So the brother that she lives with had been exposed to it heavily at work, and he had been around at the house all weekend. She had hugged him and been in close contact. The thing is, it's one of those, like, a person was, you know, like in close contact with COVID. You know, so Jamie's brother's getting tested, but right now she's not sure. I don't think she's able to come back to college right now. She's having to stay at home.
Are they making an option available for students to switch to online stuff if that happens? I don't know if that's an individual option or not.
I think it may be. I'm not entirely sure because it hasn't happened to me yet. I know they have been sitting. What?
Come from.
That doesn't happen to me yet. It probably won't, but anyway.
All right, we need to keep her in prayer.
Yeah, keep her in prayer.
This, you know, what happens in other places has nothing to say what's going to happen here. More than 1,000 students at the University of Alabama have already been exposed just at the beginning of school. 1,000 students. I mean, it's a huge school. Don't get me wrong. I guess you guys know that there's a self-reporting page at UNG, and there are a lot of students that have been infected already. When I say a lot, it's more than one, but it's not thousands by any means. And there have been 500 new cases in Montgomery County just within the last 2 weeks. And so we are at one of the highest rates of exposure in the state from the standpoint of the size of our county. We're relatively small. This is not Atlanta. And so the reasons why I went here last week and the week before is because a neighbor down the road from us was exposed. I mean, just down the road. See him all the time, talk to him. We've been trying to keep distance. It's a matter of precaution, so keep extra special distance. So I had a friend of mine, beloved brother I've known for 40 plus years, and he said this. He says, I was very naive about what I thought concerning the advancement of this virus. I thought, we're in the middle of nowhere in rural Tennessee. It never happened here. And they had to shut down everything at the church because so many people were infected, and it spread throughout that very small rural county. And he says, I apologize for being naive about how I treated this. It's, you know, being naive doesn't mean you can't get it. And I'm not politicizing. It's a health thing. You know, my wife had a heart attack earlier this year, and I'm going to do everything I can to protect her. She's going to do everything to protect herself as well. And so that doesn't mean she's going to get it, or if she does get it, it's going to be anything serious. But I don't take it lightly. It's kind of hard to defend yourself against something you can't see. So let's just be careful. But thank you for bringing that out, and keep us more about that. Doug, you have any announcement you want to make?
Yeah, Pam's home. She's doing well. Operation was very successful. She's got about